From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And in a few minutes, we'll check in on Tunisia a week after the terrorist attack on the museum there that killed 21 people. The museum was supposed to reopen today, and that did not happen because there are still some concerns about security.
But first, let's go to Washington, where President Obama is meeting with Afghanistan's new president, Ashraf Ghani, at the White House today, as Ghani tries to forge a new relationship with the U.S. after 14 years of a war that began with a search for Osama bin Laden. Yesterday, President Ghani visited the Pentagon and offered his thanks for the sacrifices U.S. troops made in his country.
Each one of you has left a legacy. But what gratifies me is what I've had the honor to hear repeatedly from American veterans. I've left a piece of my heart in Afghanistan. Thank you.
The U.S. still has about 10,000 troops on the ground in Afghanistan after formally ending the American combat mission that started there after 9/11. President Obama's original timetable called for the withdrawal of all of them by the end of 2016. Ghani wants more flexibility, and that's quite a change from the previous president of Afghanistan, Hamid Karzai, who in May said the U.S. should pull all of its troops out of the country by the end of 2014. NPR's diplomatic correspondent Michelle Kellerman is covering President Ghani's U.S. visit. She joins us now. And Michelle, what does President Ghani want? Does he want the U.S. to keep boots on the ground beyond 2016?
You know, he was hesitant to say much in public when he was at Camp David yesterday. He said this is an issue President Obama's going to have to decide. But he and many experts are expecting President Obama to delay the U.S. withdrawal plans. I mean, Afghanistan does have to get through what's become known as the spring fighting season, which begins now. And as you mentioned, there are about 10,000 troops there. Obama's original plan was to get that down to about half this year, with everyone pulled out by the end of 2016. And that looks less and less likely, Robin. There were some high-profile Afghan watchers here in Washington, former ambassadors, intelligence and Defense Department officials, who wrote an open letter today saying that a full withdrawal is going to put at risk the hard-won gains in Afghanistan. They point out that Afghan forces really rely heavily on American air power and intelligence and logistics, and that the civilian death toll is really still very high. The UN said that 10,000 civilians were killed just last year.
Well, but as Secretary of Defense Ashton Carter asked yesterday, or said yesterday, he's going to ask Congress for funding to boost Afghanistan's security forces to sustain them through 2017, which would put some of the, you know, the burden of protection on Afghan forces. But just asking for that money, isn't that going to be a tough sell in Congress after the billions of dollars the U.S. already spent there?
It does cost about $4 billion a year to do this. But I don't think anyone in Congress really thought that price tag would go away anytime soon. Because as you say, there are clear national security interests in Afghanistan. And the idea is to make sure that Afghans can take the lead in the country so that U.S. troops can eventually leave. One issue, Robin, that Congress might raise, though, in all of this are reports of human rights abuses by some Afghan units. By law, the U.S. would have to cut off aid to those rights abusers. Another concern that I'm hearing from some Afghans is that U.S. aid is too focused on the military, and the armed forces could become sort of the dominant economic power in the country.
Right. Well, you have spoken twice of people wanting to hold on to the gains in the country. How much does Iraq hang over all of this, and the talk about troop withdrawal leading to that country, you know, almost breaking into pieces?
I think that's a big part of it. We're also hearing concerns from Afghans and from U.S. officials about gains by the so-called Islamic State, ISIS having some sort of foothold in Afghanistan, and that's something they're clearly watching right now.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, what might President Ghani promise to do on one end of a bargain in order to get continued U.S. troop support? Is he being asked to reach out to Pakistan, for instance, to try to start a better peace process with the Taliban?
He has been reaching out to Pakistan and talking about the need for reconciliation. I spoke recently with the UN envoy to Afghanistan, who says that he's been trying to nurture contacts as well under the radar for the time being. And the U.S. has always said that it supports a peace process in which the Taliban renounces violence and abides by the country's constitution and breaks links with al-Qaeda. Of course, this new element of ISIS gaining some sort of foothold in Afghanistan is something that the U.S. is going to have to watch, too.
And, of course, Michelle Kellerman, as we note this historical moment, this new Afghan president coming to the White House after a 14-year war in the country, we're reminded of how many lives were lost there. So we want to mention that as well. NPR's diplomatic correspondent, Michelle Kellerman, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, the museum attacked by terrorists in Tunisia last week is postponing its reopening. The National Bardo Museum was supposed to reopen to visitors today, but instead there was only a symbolic ceremony. The full opening is being pushed back to this weekend. 21 people were killed last Wednesday after gunmen started firing at tourists. Two gunmen were shot dead by police. The BBC's Rana Jawad joins us from Tunis. And Rana, why was the reopening delayed? Are they worried about another attack?
Not necessarily. There are no signs or suggestions that there was, any threat of an imminent attack. But it, you know, for a lot of people, even in the run-up to this reopening that was to be and didn't happen, people did question, you know, why is it reopening so soon? It's only been 6 days. And perhaps it's rushed. But I think, you know, there was a sense of urgency in reopening it because they wanted to send out a message to say that we are in control and we can protect our visitors because this is a country that depends on tourism for its livelihood. So it was very important for them to kind of project an image of, you know, everything's back to normal. And they thought that reopening the museum would do that.
And unfortunately, as you say, they won't be able to do that fully today. What can you tell us about the attack and what we know about it at this point? There was a claim of responsibility from ISIS, but we don't know much more than that about who might have been behind this attack. Do we know more at this point?
Not really. I mean, it's very difficult to assess with these kind of attacks, and I say this because I've I was in Libya last week, which is where my base was up until recently. We've seen attacks like that there before, and often you will have ISIS related social media accounts claiming responsibility for it and naming the people that were involved in it, and usually when they release pictures it pretty much becomes obvious that it was coordinated somehow with some base that is in direct contact with ISIS. Who they were exactly, we don't know for sure. There were three attackers at the museum. Two of them are dead, and one of them is said to be on the run. But yeah, and they've also said that some of them have had some training in neighboring Libya. And Libya, again, of course, is going through its own period of lawlessness and chaos with a much larger presence of Islamic State-related groups. So there is a claim that they got trained there as well.
Well, let me ask you about the differences between the two places. You say you're based usually in Libya. These are two countries that underwent revolutions during the Arab Spring. The one in Libya obviously has fallen apart with these rival governments competing for power. But in Tunisia, the government is still in place. What are the differences in the feelings and the hopes of the people there in Tunisia from what you see in Libya, especially given this attack?
I think on the ground, the difference is vast. Libya is a country that is it's a lawless country, and it really has no effective government, and it's ruled by the gun, by various militias with different ideologies and different regional and city and town allegiances. So it's a very complicated scenario there, and it can't be compared to Tunisia on any level. I think the similarities you'll find, and they're not many, is that, being in Tunisia, you talk to people and you'll find a lot of anger here that has been bottled up over the last few years since the overthrow of President Ben Ali from power. A lot of people feel like this may have been the first major attack in the capital, but it certainly won't be the last that they'll see. It's become an unstable place, and neighboring countries will inevitably be affected.
Are you seeing any tourists in Tunisia following the attack?
Yes, there are still tourists. We didn't see any kind of mass exodus after that attack. It was very much, I think, taken in the same stride as the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, and seen as a one-off incident, perhaps a very disturbing one, especially for a small country like Tunisia. But we have heard from some hotel managers and also some figures coming out on local media that there have been some cancellations of people who had been planning to come here. But the ones who were here, we haven't really seen anyone, you know, consciously make a decision, I should just leave now.
That's the BBC's Rana Jawad speaking with us from Tunis in Tunisia as a partial reopening of the museum that was attacked last week gets underway today. Rana, thank you.
Thank you.
The energy company Kinder Morgan is trying to get clearance to convert an existing 14,000-mile pipeline that runs from the northeast to Texas to transport the byproducts of gas drilling instead of natural gas. The byproducts are called natural gas liquids, or NGLs. They're very marketable. They're also volatile. And that has some people in Kentucky, which the pipeline passes through, worried. Erica Peterson from Here and Now contributor WFPL in Louisville reports.
Marion County, Kentucky is mostly farmland, and almost as ubiquitous as silos, split rail fences, and hay bales are the white and yellow poles sticking out of the ground, subtle signs marking the paths of the six natural gas pipelines that cross the area.
The gas lines start crossing right in here.
That's Joe Spalding. He's a Marion County resident, and one of these lines crosses his land. Spalding and his friend, Larry Caldwell, point out each one.
Here's one that comes across. Here's another one right here.
Right now, this pipeline owned by energy giant Kinder Morgan is carrying natural gas from the Gulf Coast through Kentucky. But soon, it could be carrying something called natural gas liquids, or NGLs. And for Spalding, that raises a lot of questions.
What kind of product they're going to run through? What is the dangers? What kind of exposure is there? Nobody's told us anything. That's some of the things we'd like to know.
Kinder Morgan wants to convert this pipeline to carry NGLs. They're the byproducts of natural gas drilling, hydrocarbons such as ethane, butane, and propane. NGLs are used to make plastics, synthetic rubber, and antifreeze, and they're worth money. But first, companies need a way to get the NGLs from drilling operations in the Northeast to processing plants in the South. Critics of the project say swapping out natural gas for NGLs isn't an even trade when it comes to pipeline regulations and safety.
Natural gas, you have a leak, it either explodes or dissipates.
Tom Fitzgerald is an environmental attorney in Louisville.
Natural gas liquids, you have a leak, you end up with an asphyxiation hazard because they tend to cling near the ground. You have an explosion hazard because they are flammable. And then you have a groundwater pollution and land pollution problem.
In the past 3 years, there have been two large NGL leaks into waterways, one in Colorado and one in Iowa. That worries some property owners. And they're also concerned about the age of the pipeline in question. Washington, D.C. oil and gas attorney Elizabeth Myers says given the risks from a possible NGL leak, it might not be the best idea to use a 70-year-old pipeline.
The pipeline safety regulations are getting stricter and stronger all the time. And so I really don't think that it's comparable to the time of when that pipeline was first put in.
A spokeswoman for Kinder Morgan told me that the company will extensively evaluate the pipeline to make sure it's up to current code and able to safely transport NGLs. The company also says it will perform additional tests for safety and integrity before placing the line into service. Back in Marion County, Larry Caldwell and Joe Spalding stand near several of the gas pipeline's metering stations. They buzz and hiss in the cold winter air. Cattle belonging to Caldwell's brother graze nearby. The two men say they're worried the community will be shouldering all of the risk of a natural gas liquids pipeline with none of the benefits. Caldwell says the natural gas line at least had a purpose.
It helped places along the way. This is not going to help anybody along the way. Best I can understand, they're piping it from up north to the Gulf and then going to send it somewhere. So it's not really a benefit to anybody here that I can find out.
Kinder Morgan doesn't yet have customers for the natural gas byproducts that would be carried by its pipeline and says it won't move forward until it does. But the company did file its application with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission last month to convert the pipeline. It could be a year or longer before the commission approves or rejects the project. For Here and Now, I'm Erica Peterson in Louisville.
Well, now to a different kind of pipe. A while back, we had a little backup at the house. The plumber asked, "Do you use baby wipes?" We said, "No, babies visit, but no." He said, "I'm talking about adults. You should see what baby wipes are doing to New York. New York City has spent millions fixing pipes and equipment clogged by baby wipes. Last month, the city council proposed a ban on claims and advertising that wipes are flushable. Dr. Oz, once a fan of wipes, is now asking viewers to please use moistened toilet paper instead. It's not just New York. In Charleston, West Virginia, the operations manager said, "I agree wipes are flushable. A golf ball is flushable, but you shouldn't do it." The point being, they don't degrade. So what can we all learn from London? Well, plenty, but a warning, especially if you're dining, this may not be pleasant. In 2013 in London, wipes, human waste, and two swimming pool-sized vats of turkey fat from Christmas dinners congealed to form one of the biggest fatbergs London had ever seen, maybe 15 tons. What's a fatberg? Let's bring in Craig Rance, campaign communications executive for Thames Water, who's on Skype from London. Craig, what is a fatberg?
A fatberg is a big congealed lump of leftover cooking fat, which has been poured down sinks after cooking. Even stuff like oil or olive oil is the same. It goes down and it calcifies in the sewers. And the baby wipes and the so-called flushable wipes that we say are never flushable help bind it together. It's like a bricks and mortar. And eventually what you end up with is a large mass of fat, which is rock hard. It goes hard like chalk. And once it's in there, it's a lot of work to get it out.
But is it possible one was 15 tons?
It was the same weight as a few double-decker buses in a sewer in southwest London. Lovely, leafy suburb, but unfortunately, yes. And it broke the sewer pipe to such an extent that we had to dig up the road for 6 months to repair the damage that these fatbergs can do.
This is amazing. Well, and you have workers who have to wade through 43,000 miles. You've got this beautiful, actually, sewer system under the City of London. What do they have to do?
Well, I've joined them. I've been there down there with them. So you have to put on a protective suit. Looks very much like CSI. We're wearing thigh-high waders and waiting till the water level drops so it's below your hips. And anything that they can move initially, they're breaking up with shovels. But the rest of the time, they're either having to go in with high-power jet washers and clear it that way and suck it out. And this is a big waste product which has to go to landfill. Now, it sounds disgusting, and it really is disgusting, but it's the effect that this stuff can have. So once it's in the sewers, once it's set, it means that water can't get past. So all your showers, your sinks, your toilets all empty into the same pipe, then into the sewer system. And if that can't get past, you're going to get your toilet backing up through your bath.
Yeah, and because of baby wipes. And in the case in London, fat from turkeys. What's happened there? I mean, is there a campaign there to get people to stop flushing both?
Yes. We're working to get a flushability standard that will go worldwide to make sure that anything which has flushable on it, as you said, a golf ball is flushable, actually meets the breaking down standards. So it won't clog and it won't get to the sewer pumps and wrap around the machinery and break it, which we get a lot of. And also to encourage people to understand that when they finish cooking and they have leftover fat, to put it into a jar or wipe it out and get it in the bin. And that's why our campaign's called Bin It, Don't Block It.
So bin, by bin you mean a garbage can. But how much does this cost? And is the cost passed on?
So we actually spend just ourselves, Thames Water, we spend £1 million every month. So about $1.5 million that we have to then charge to our customers. So they're putting their own bills up. But like you said, this isn't just us. This is worldwide. We talk regularly with the other water companies around the world about this issue.
Look, you say that you're working on a flushability standard, but we're hearing that there may not be one, that there's something called the slosh box test. And this is, you know, you try to show what an agitation would be like of something going through a pipe and whether or not something will break down. But people are saying they just don't break down and it's not worth it. What about just saying, never mind flushability, none of them can be flushed?
That's what we do say. Yeah. Nothing should go down. Only toilet paper and human waste. So nothing should have flushable written on the side of it.
So you seem like you're a little bit ahead of American cities. Is it helping? Is the word getting out?
In 2013, when we had the massive Fatberg, that story really captured people's imaginations. It ended up as the UK's most Googled story of the year. So, and that did have a downward effect on the number of blockages. But we need to keep it at the forefront of people's minds because we're humans. We treat the toilet like a magic portal. As soon as it goes in, as soon as we press flush, it's gone into the same small pipe, which is probably only, it's probably slightly smaller than a baseball.
Huh. By the way, do you have any idea, this kind of escaped me, why are adults using baby wipes?
So baby wipes will be used as cleaning products, be used for taking makeup off. It can be used for personal hygiene. You may have seen recently Will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas was a big exponent of actually using the bathroom, not using toilet tissue, but using baby wipes instead.
So what?
Yes, that was in the paper. He was saying that he would only ever use baby wipes after he'd been to the bathroom.
I'm not sure that I need to hear anything about Will.i.am's or anyone's hygiene.
Problem was he was in London at the time. So we sent a message to him to ask him to please stop because it was blocking up our sewers, and our sewer flushers were not very happy with that at all.
You need to get Will.i.am on your new campaign. Craig Rantz with Thames Water in London. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will hear arguments in Michigan versus the Environmental Protection Agency, a case that centers on whether the EPA unreasonably refused to consider cost when adopting new regulations on the pollution from coal and oil-fired power plants. The regulations, which are set to go into effect this spring, would require plants to reduce emissions of mercury, arsenic, and other toxic metals and gases by nearly 90%. Jeff Holmstead is a former head of the Clean Air Office at the EPA under President George W. Bush. He's currently an attorney in private practice representing energy companies. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Well, where do you come down on this? Do you think the EPA should have to factor in cost to the companies when deciding whether new regulations on power plants are appropriate and necessary?
Well, you have to remember it's not just cost to the companies, it's cost to ratepayers ultimately. And certainly, historically, it's been thought that it makes sense for an agency to consider whether the cost of the rule would outweigh the benefits. So that's a short way of saying, yes, I do think EPA should have considered cost.
Well, and they would say that it was a $9.6 billion cost to the industry, but that it would also benefit the public to the tune of $37 to $90 billion in health care costs because of some of the health problems that come from these pollutants.
Well, that's a little misleading because this regulation is supposed to be, as you say, about regulating mercury and other air toxics. These big estimates that EPA gives for the benefits of the rule really have nothing to do with regulating these pollutants. And there's a whole other part of the Clean Air Act that EPA is supposed to be using to be regulating those pollutants. So it's very difficult to talk through all of these issues, except the key question the Supreme Court is going to be dealing with is whether EPA was unreasonable in saying we're not even going to look at the cost when we decided it was appropriate to regulate under this particular section of the Act.
So you're saying the burden should be on the regulators to prove why additional regulations are necessary rather than the burden being on the polluters to show that they should be able to continue doing what they're doing?
Well, I don't know how you would do it otherwise because the actor is obviously the agency. And so the agency needs to consider whether what it proposes to do is justified by the costs and the benefits. So I don't know how else you would do it. And I would say that, you know, this particular case has involved almost half the states. I mean, this is not just EPA versus the industry. There are states who are challenging the rule, who are concerned about the precedent that EPA can do regulation without considering the cost of that regulation.
How do you expect the court will rule on this?
Well, you know, it's always hard to predict what the Supreme Court will do. We have a hint from a case a couple of years ago where the court seemed to endorse the use of what's called cost-benefit analysis. So I think it would not be a surprise at all if the court were to send EPA back and say, you really need to go back to the beginning of this process and Before you can decide that it's appropriate to regulate, you need to look at the cost of that regulation.
Jeff Olmsted, who is an attorney in private practice representing energy companies. He's the former head of the Clean Air Office at the EPA. Jeff, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's here and now.
It's time to get going again.
Neil deGrasse Tyson, astrophysicist and director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York, frequent guest on The Daily Show, and a guest here on Here and Now, and of course, host of his own wildly popular series, Cosmos, is soon going to join the late-night talk show wars, although from a decidedly different slant. His show, Star Talk, on the National Geographic Channel, will be based on his podcast of the same name, and Neil deGrasse Tyson joins us from New York to talk about it. Welcome.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So are you going to have a band?
So I think the initial media pulse that responded to the press release, I think they overreacted.
Well, I'm sure everyone thought he's replacing Colbert.
Here comes Tyson in late night, busting into the saloon with the double hinged doors. No, I have a podcast and it's called Star Talk Radio. And through an agreement with National Geographic, they took interest in filming and airing 10 of them this spring.
Taped in front of a live audience at the Hayden Planetarium. What fun. What are you going to talk about? Because we're going to hear a little of your podcast in a second, and the range of guests is extraordinary.
The whole construct of Star Talk is to invert the typical expectation of how you would learn science. So normally you'd think you tune in and there's a journalist interviewing a scientist. This is the inverse of that, where I'm the host and I'm the scientist, and my guests are hardly ever taken from the field of science. They're hewn from pop culture. And the conversation during Star Talk is about all the ways that science has impacted that person's livelihood from childhood on through adulthood.
Well, for instance, we have a clip of you with the late Joan Rivers. At one point, you asked her if she was interested in living in space, where we know there's little or no gravity. And here's some of her reply.
What I've thought about is I know that if you go around the Earth, if you go backwards, you get younger.
Oh, that was in the movie Superman.
Yeah.
But that's not real, though. That was just Superman.
Well, apparently Suzanne Somers now lives in a rocket ship. So, no, I don't like any of that stuff. I don't like the outfits. So I wouldn't live in outer space.
So it's all about the clothes.
Yes. I'm sorry. You got the wrong person here.
I don't know if you have more Joan Rivers clips, but I have to add one. There's one where I said, so Joan, what do you think about the aliens, that people are seeing? She said, I don't care if we're visited by aliens, as long as they're single and Jewish. So on Star Talk, we just have fun with science, and you get to learn that people who you wouldn't think about science, think about science more often than you thought.
Well, we know that because you've got 3 million followers on Twitter. There's millions that listen already to the podcast. By the way, tweets you sent out caught our eye. In one you wrote, wouldn't it be cool if zombies and vampires became human if we bit them first? Somebody needs to test this hypothesis.
Exactly.
Obviously trying to reach to younger people, zombies all the rage. But do you ever worry that serious science, talking about global warming and things like that, isn't getting covered?
Well, so first, my target is adults. And if kids happen to be listening and learn something, that's great. Adults outnumber kids 5-1. They're in charge. They wield resources and funding and opportunity. So it's the science illiteracy of the adult population that concerns me vastly more than whatever is going on with children. Because if you fix the adult problem, then the kids just follow immediately when that happens. I'm not going to try to create a population of scientifically literate middle schoolers and then wait 40 years for them to become president. I'm not that patient.
Are you worried about with adults? What are you worried about that adults are not paying attention to?
Well, lately in the modern body politic, the people are cherry picking science. And I don't know that this country, that has precedent in this country. If you cherry pick science, that's the end of your informed democracy. You are making decisions not based on any kind of emergent truths, which are established by the methods and tools of science.
Are you referring to evolution or what are you?
Anything. It's anything. And by the way, it doesn't have to be whether you are cherry picking because of your religion. You could be cherry picking because of your politics or from any other philosophy that's driving your life. And you are not. And if you, by the way, in a free country, you can do what you want, but if you also are charged with creating policy, then you are creating policy based on what you want to be true, consistent with your philosophy, rather than what is actually true, consistent with the emergent truths of science. And so you shouldn't really be tasked with creating legislation and laws if you want to cherry pick your science for your belief system. And that's all I'm saying, because your laws affect everybody, and not everybody shares your belief system. So laws should be based on objective truths.
And in the past, you've said, though, that debating, let's say, climate change deniers isn't worth your time. But is it, given what you just said?
Yeah, that assumes that, oh, let's both stand up front, and there's an audience, and whoever wins the debate is right. No, that's not how it works. You know, whoever has a clever turn of phrase, I'm sorry, that's not, I don't debate anybody, all right? I select what I post as emergent scientific truth, and I put it out there.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of your thoughts on the science of climate change from your recent show, Cosmos.
Climate has changed many times in the long history of the Earth, but always in response to a global force. The strongest force driving climate change right now is the increasing CO2 from the burning of fossil fuels, which is trapping more heat from the sun. All that additional energy has to go somewhere. Some of it warms the air. Most of it ends up in the oceans. All over the world, the oceans are getting warmer.
That's Neil deGrasse Tyson from his television show Cosmos. His new TV show, Star Talk, based on his radio podcast, will be premiering next month on the National Geographic Channel. And Neil, you're going to have, as you say, non-scientists, but how do you decide what you're going to talk to them about?
Oh, so I don't predetermine that. I'll just give you an example. During the podcast, I interviewed Josh Groban. Now, he far better known to women than to men. He's a crooner, singer, composer, and interviewed him. And so what is he doing on Star Talk? Well, that's where you would have learned that in high school, for his science fair project, he attached mirrors to the surface of a speaker cone, angled lasers into those mirrors, played music through that speaker cone, and watched the points of laser light dance on the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And I said, yes, there's perfect street cred for the geekosphere right there. And you would never know this. And the point of Star Talk for me is to tease out of people or find ways that people can share with us all the ways that science has mattered to them.
And we find out these things because of the great questions you ask. And so I'm going to ask one of you. If you had the Neil deGrasse Tyson dinner party and they'd all be scientists past and present, who'd you want there?
Oh, I think about this all the time. And then once I think it through, I realize the impracticality of it, and then I abandon the idea, right? So I would have Archimedes, I'd have Aristotle, I would have Hypatia, I would have Isaac Newton. I think I want to stay before 20th century, but that's just a historical bias. I like really old stuff. So I put all these people around the table, and then I'd realize half of them don't speak English. So how do I get that one to work? And then Isaac Newton, if I had one dinner guest, it would be Isaac Newton, who, of course, does speak English, being a British scientist. But then I realized I would say, so Isaac, you know, we're driving cars around. He said, well, what's a car? And I said, well, okay, it's a horse-drawn carriage without a horse. Well, then how does it move? I say, through an engine. They said, what's an engine? Or I say, well, it runs on gasoline. Well, what's gasoline? Well, we derived it from oil. Well, what's oil? You know, there's no, you can't have a conversation. You'd spend the entire dinner just establishing common vocabulary. Isaac Newton's day, there were no engines. There were no machines that converted energy of one kind into energy of another. That would be the hallmark of the Industrial Revolution, that his equations, his work that established that the universe was knowable, would birth. So I'd want to have that dinner with him to show him what has come of his work, but it would be a very difficult conversation.
Well, and forget about Archimedes from ancient Greece. astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, thank you, first of all, for letting us inside your head. He's going to be host of the late-night talk show Star Talk, which is based on his popular podcast. We'll link you up to everything at hereandnow.org. Neil, as always, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And have you heard about Meerkat yet? It's the latest craze sweeping social media with more than 400,000 users less than a month after the app launched. Kurt Wagner, editor of social media for Recode, is with us. He's a part of our weekly guide to the world of tech. And Kurt, what is Meerkat exactly, first of all?
Well, hi, Jeremy. Thanks for having me. Meerkat is a new app that really took off at the South by Southwest Festival down in Austin a few weeks ago. And what it does is it enables users to use their smartphone to broadcast live stream video and audio. So I would open the app, I would start a stream, and then anybody on the internet could click the link to my stream and essentially follow along with what I'm showing them through my smartphone. So everyone becomes a broadcaster, essentially.
Does it work well? Are there glitches?
I mean, there's, you know, the technology is somewhat new, so I've had issues with the stream being not so strong. I've had some battery issues with my phone, where if you use the stream for too long, then you're not going to be able to, have your phone battery last all day while you're doing that. So it's definitely not perfect, but I think the technology with the smartphones is getting to a point where this probably wouldn't have even been possible a year or 2 years ago.
Well, I'm thinking of, there's an app actually that we often use in public radio to allow people to send good quality audio to us, and there is an ability on that app to do a live stream of that audio, but it's not the kind of thing that I would want to use on a regular basis live on the air, because there are a lot of glitches. But with Meerkat, do users have to pay for this? Are they getting the kind of investment that they need?
So right now, the app is free in the App Store. And so it's a pretty low barrier to entry, as they like to say, in that there's really no hindrance on the user to sign up, right? I mean, the one exception is you need to have a Twitter account to sign up. You sign up through Meerkat with Twitter. So with that being the only real investment you need to make is signing up for the account, it's made it really easy for people to feel like they can broadcast from anywhere. And you could see how this use case could be important as people start using it to broadcast news or to broadcast protests that are happening in the streets, whatever it may be. It kind of gives people around the world an immediate view into a certain location that they otherwise wouldn't get to see.
But you're saying right now it runs only on Twitter, which, by the way, in January acquired a rival live streaming app called Periscope for $100 million. How does that work out?
So that's going to be fun. That's going to be fun to watch. Meerkat launched a few weeks before South by, so I want to say they're coming up on a month now. And everyone immediately thought, well, this would be a perfect acquisition target for Twitter, right? They're using Twitter to help broadcast the streams. You had to have a Twitter account to sign up. And then it was reported that, well, hold on, Twitter already bought a live streaming service called Periscope. It's still in beta mode, so people haven't really seen what Periscope looks like yet. But Twitter has made a few changes to how Meerkat can leverage its social graph, is what they call. So essentially the network of people on Twitter. And they kind of cut that off for Meerkat, essentially signaling that, hey, we're going to have a competitor coming soon, and we want to give all those benefits to our Periscope app versus your Meerkat app. So it's going to be interesting to see, you know, the two products do battle once Twitter does eventually launch Periscope.
Kurt, your colleague Peter Kafka spoke to Meerkat's founder Ben Rubin, who is a 27-year-old former architecture student from Israel. And Rubin talked about the challenge of familiarizing users with live streaming and keeping them active. He compared it to some of the photo apps like Instagram that he says have an easier time simply substituting for old-fashioned cameras. Let's listen.
When a software substitute came, like Instagram, it was a natural transition. Like, we knew the standards. What is a good picture? How it should look like? What does it mean? On live video, we don't have it. My parents didn't live stream.
Right.
I'm not sure that even if you ask people in the street, do you live stream?
Right.
It's a habit that people have. And I think that the most important thing to a platform to do is to educate what is a good live stream.
Kurt, do we have any sense at this point of what a good live stream is for Meerkat?
I don't believe that we do, and I do think that there's an issue here around etiquette with live streaming. It was something that I experienced firsthand as I've seen people using the app out in the wild, if you will. And what I mean by that is that people are recording and they're including others in their live recording without asking for permission or letting them know that they're recording them. And to me, that I see that as a major problem. You know, if I'm sitting down at a bar in a restaurant, at a table in a restaurant, and someone nearby is live streaming, and all of a sudden my conversations are being broadcast to the internet,
yeah,
that's not something I'm going to love. So I think that as this trend picks up and it becomes more mainstream, people are going to have to figure out what's an appropriate live stream, what's an appropriate way to let others around them know that they're live streaming. And I don't think we have that yet.
Kurt Wagner, editor of social media for Recode, our weekly guide to the world of tech, talking with us about Meerkat. We'll link you to more about it at our website, hereandnow.org. Kurt, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Robin, we couldn't talk about Meerkat without hearing from a real Meerkat. Here
Let's
it is.
Listen. That's not a real... No, Nathan Lane is the Meerkat.
We'll see if we can find that for tomorrow's show. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.